Hello, everybody, and welcome to the History of Actor Training in the British Drama School podcast. I really hope you're enjoying these podcasts, and if you're new to the podcast, well, I hope you enjoy it. It's a weekly podcast, and every week I try and look at a different aspect of the history of actor training in the British Drama School. Sometimes that's about the way people teach, sometimes it's about particular teachers or their methods. We've looked at questions, a little bit of accreditation. I may look at things like funding. So it's a fairly free sort of ramble around the whole history that I'm hoping will add up to something useful and maybe even significant. And the reason why I'm doing this is partly just out of my own curiosity and an obsession love, really, for the drama school, and also concern, I suppose, about the direction of travel. It's very clear to any of us who work in drama schools or are interested in them that the drama school is going through shifts and changes. And hopefully that will be a useful and important and productive phase in its development. But I suppose my thesis would be that I'm not entirely sure that as a community, as a profession or industry, I suppose, that we maybe have enough understanding of the thing itself to really productively shift its direction. So I think we should try and know our own history. That's my thought. This week, I'd like to spend a little bit of time with Sarah Thorne, and in particular, actually, with an actress called Winifred Dolan, who was a Victorian actress whose career stretched into the Edwardian period. Winifred Dolan goes and spends time at the Sarah Thorne Academy, which is attached to the Theatre Royal in Margate. And Sarah Thorne, I think you could argue, is probably the closest thing, or Sarah Thorne's school is the closest thing to a successful institution for actor training in the 19th century. We'll hear in a moment that there were various schools and tutors and attempts to set things up, but Sarah Thorne's really worked for a fairly brief period. Sarah Thorne was in Margate. She also had a theatre in Chatham, and actually died in Chatham in the Medway Towns, which, as it happens, is my hometown. It's the place where I lived. So I don't know how many people in Chatham are aware of the fact that they have a sort of a place, or that Chatham has a place in the history of actor training in the British Drama School, but it does. Just to sort of set the scene on Sarah Thorne's. Oh, and another fascinating thing about Sarah Thorne is that she died in Chatham, but she was buried in Brompton Cemetery in West London, the very same cemetery where Fanny Kelly is buried. I assume that's a complete coincidence, but it means if you wanted to have a picnic, you could go to Brompton Cemetery, which has it's an important cemetery, and it has a nice coffee shop in it when coffee shops are open again. So you could go to Brompton Cemetery, you could have a coffee and a bun, and then you could go and see the graves of both Frances Maria Kelly, Fanny Kelly of Dean Street and Drury Lane, and Sarah Thorne of the Theatre Royal Margate. I'm not sure this will come up in the things I'm reading, but Sarah Thorne once played Ophelia to Edmund Kean's Hamlet in the Theatre Royal Dublin. So she was a major actor, was Sarah Thorne. The first thing I'm going to read to give us some context about sort of what was going on in late 19th century actor training is from a chapter called The Training of the Actor Before 1914. And it's from a book called From Irving to Olivier, by Michael Sanderson, A Social History of the Acting Profession, 1880 to 1983. It's a completely brilliant book, a wonderful book if you have any interest in these kinds of things. So Michael Sanderson, chapter two, he sort of sketched what was going on in Victorian theatre before that. And then he says, one of the most important developments in the professionalisation of the actor in the 1900s, the whole book, by the way, is about what he says about the sort of social history of the acting profession and indeed of the actor. So the theme that he tracks is the way that actors become sort of professional and to some degree respectable, moving from the Victorian to the Edwardian period and then into the 20th century. One of the most important developments in the professionalisation of the actor in the 1900s was the creation of new, better organised forms of drama education. I think he really means actor training, I think. However valuable amateur experience was as a preparation for the stage, dissatisfaction was expressed with the lack of opportunities for formal training. F.C. Burnand complained, "It is called a self-educating profession, and it is evident that the theatrical profession, left to itself for education, is a very indifferent, if not absolutely bad, school." Okay. Victorian actors had learned their craft on the job by imitating fellow members of their company. At the worst, old faults would be perpetuated, and even at best, the tyro was gaining his training at the expense of the public, who were expected to pay for the barely trained and inexperienced performer. Well, that still sort of happens now, doesn't it? I've quite often sat in big theatres and had that feeling. This was hardly the mark of a profession. In 1879, an acting academy was proposed as part of the new Shakespeare Memorial Theatre, but this came to nothing, as did further proposals in 1882. That also connects up with sort of the calls for a national theatre that took so long to be realised. There was a tradition of private tutors in the latter 19th century, but it was in the 1900s that the two major academies emerged. Sir Herbert Tree's Academy of Dramatic Art, which is going to turn into the RADA that we still have today, and Elsie Fogarty's Central School, now currently known as the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama. The Royal was added quite recently, only a few years ago. These changes brought about a revolution in the training of the actor, a raised level of seriousness and professionalism. Various factors gave greater urgency to the need for more formal training. For example, upper class, public school and university men who were coming onto the stage spoke the language of their social class. It was complained that they don't pronounce half their words at all. Pronounced here for here, there for there, and adequate as this may have been in the drawing room, it did not project in the theatre. That's an interesting thought, isn't it? So, according to Michael Sanderson, perhaps part of the problem was that the accents of sort of posh folk was not a useful dialect for working on the stage. Interesting thought. This problem is exacerbated by the increasing size of theatres. I like this thought. This is really interesting. I don't know where Michael Sanderson got this thought from, but it's quite an original thought. The three surviving unremodeled theatres of the 1880s, Comedy, Lyric, Garrick, played the Garrick, know the Lyric quite well, not sure what Comedy Theatre, have an average capacity of 850 and a mean proscenium width of 27 feet. So they're quite sort of nice little theatres. Those built in the 1903 to 1907 cluster have an average capacity of about 10,018 and a remarkably uniform 30 to 31 foot proscenium, and accordingly made greater technical demands on the actor. Even experienced players appreciated their defects. Mrs. Campbell had to go into a nursing home in 1897 with fatigue and overstrain. She reflected that if she had had a proper training, I would have known how to spare my emotional temperament and to depend a little on skill technique. If even Mrs. Pat felt that she would have benefited from a drama school, it was evident that such training would have been even more valuable for actors of more modest endowments. I think there's a whole paper somewhere on Patrick Campbell's Mrs. Patrick Campbell's vocal problems and the connection between her misuse and her sort of emotional intensity. I might try and find that. I think I remember reading that. Interesting. So slightly bigger theatres maybe were connected to the rise of the drama school. Before the foundation of the two leading drama schools in the 1900s, Tree's Academy and Elsie Fogarty's Central School, there were already individual tutors and schools purporting to teach drama and elocution. These varied greatly in quality and staying power, and some were of an incompetence verging on the fraudulent. In the 1880s, John Martin Harvey answered an advertisement in the Daily Telegraph purporting to teach the whole art of acting, with engagements guaranteed for 2 guineas. This turned out to be an inoffensive little man reading from a penny number in a sordid room. When tackled about the guaranteed engagements, his tutor blandly replied, "Ah, you buy a copy of The Era and we will look at the advertisements." The Era was a major theatrical sort of newspaper at the time. With so many so desperate to go onto the stage, and with no clear standards, such as in other professions, could be guaranteed by the older universities, drama training was an area wide open to the ill-equipped charlatan. I don't know if there are any ill-equipped charlatans knocking around, but I've been noticing on various sort of Facebook groups to do with actor training and actors in London, and there are various sites, a lot of people selling their wares these days. I don't know if that's it feels like quite a new thing. I suppose the Zoom and internet and COVID and lockdown and cost of education, all of that, I suppose, is certainly would produce a fertile ground for lots of independent teachers and teaching, lots of different academies, lots and lots and lots of things happening, some of which I'm sure are very good. So I'm suggesting that those teachers are all ill-equipped charlatans teaching in the internet equivalent of sordid little rooms. But it's certainly a thing that's on my mind at the moment. I mean, I'm curious about it. What will happen? Yet what is remarkable, I mean, including me, I mean, I do sessions, I do stuff, I do classes. So I guess I could be an inoffensive little man in a sordid room for two guineas. Yet what's remarkable is not so much this aspect as the lively culture of private tuition for the stage provided by a wide variety of tutors and small schools of high reputation. This becomes a little thesis for Michael Sanderson. He seems to have decided that actually things, there were quite a lot of good stuff going on. It's nice. These are of various types. Schools associated with acting companies, individual coaches, private institutionalised academies, and finally, elocution, taught in officially established public colleges, chiefly concerned with other matters. Sure, we'll get to that, but that's going to include the London Academy of Music, which turns into the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art, my own beloved Lambda. Especially valuable were schools or facilitators for training attached to working theatrical companies. To some extent, the old stock companies had served as schools, even if informally, with the older actors passing on their experience to the newcomers. However, quite preeminent among stock companies giving training was that of Sarah Thorne at Margate. She ran the Theatre Royal as her father had before her. Margate, as a healthy seaside town, had many private schools for various purposes, and Sarah opened her school of acting there in 1885. She received pupils who were charged £20 for 3 months or £30 for 6 months. It's good value for money, isn't it? 6 months for less than twice. Boarding at Sarah's house, the Towers, in the square. George Arliss, who was one of her company, recalled that her method was to engage about half a dozen experienced actors and actresses for the leading parts and use her students for the rest of the cast, so that the pupils were continually playing before a paying audience. The pupils attended daily classes in acting, voice production, gesture and mime, dialects and makeup, took part in rehearsals and either watched or participated in performances in the evening. I think I looked up the Towers, not sort of today, a few months ago, and I think it's still there. I think Sarah Thorne's Towers are still in Margate. Somebody could in Margate could let me know. And I think they're currently a sort of school of English for people from overseas. So Margate is still obviously a place where lots of that kind of teaching goes on. The pupils, in view of the cost of the fees and boarding, were fairly affluent. In Arliss's day, the pupils were sons and daughters of prosperous businessmen, of well-to-do actors, of lawyers, authors and clergymen. Miss Thorne was indeed tapping that flush of children from business and professional families who entered the profession between 1890 and 1914. Before that, acting was a more sort of working class or even sort of precariat profession. It's one of the things that in the whole book Michael Sanderson traces. He's interested in this sort of shift. Her school was also taken seriously by leading London theatre people, who either sent their children to study there, as did Ellen Terry, or attended performances, as did Irving and Granville Barker. I think Granville Barker studies too. Yeah, I think he does. So when we spend some time with Winifred Dolan, we're going to meet Granville Barker and Ellen Terry's son, the famous Gordon Craig. Among the actors and actresses who passed through Sarah Thorne's hands were Irene, and Violet Vanbrugh, and Ellen Terry's son, Gordon Craig. Sarah Thorne died in 1899 and the school ceased, but during its life in the 80s and 90s, it trained more actors and actresses who were to achieve success in the 1900s than any other school. Irene and Violet Vanbrugh were the sisters of Kenneth Barnes, or Kenneth Barnes was their brother, who's going to take over as the principal of RADA. And there was an Irish actress, I think her name is Eileen O'Malley, who was a student of Sarah Thorne's school, who developed acting at the Webber Douglas Academy in the late 1920s. So Sarah Thorne's influence, to some degree, extended into those two great London drama schools. So that's Sarah Thorne. I'm just going to keep reading because I quite like the feeding in of information about Ben Greet and Frank Benson and a few other folks. So I'll finish this bit of the chapter. Ben Greet was a noted actor-manager and a former pupil of Sarah Thorne's. Oh, I didn't know that. Who ran several touring companies presenting Shakespeare in the provinces and pastorally in Regent's Park. At Irving's suggestion, he started his Academy of Acting in 1896. It was held in Bedford Street, the Strand, and had the advantage of a large room at the top of the building used as a theatre, the Bijou Theatre, where tuition could be given. It was scarcely less an advantage than the premises were over the Bodega, a leading prose job-finding pub. I wonder if that's still in London, the Bodega. Here, the students were given the usual curriculum of acting, voice production, dancing, fencing, and play production. Ben Greet, on returning from his tours, rehearsed the pupils carefully, and public performances were given at the end of term. On the results of these, and their general progress, the best pupils were invited to join one of Greet's companies. Accordingly, Sybil Thorndike played her earliest parts as a student with Ben Greet's pastoral players in production staged in Cambridge and Oxford College Gardens in 1904. Still see plays in Oxford and Cambridge College Gardens in the summer, hopefully this summer again. As well as the Thorndikes, H.B. Irving and Mrs. Patrick Campbell, who we just heard about before, both owed some of their early training to Greet's company. The third major company school was that attached to Frank Benson's troupe. Whereas there would always be a certain amount of informal help from the experienced to the newcomers in his company, Benson decided to formalise this as a school from 1901. Whereas the Thorne Company was based in Margate and Ben Greet's school remained fixed in London, Benson's school was unusual in being itinerant and travelling with the company. On joining, a student paid about £50 or £60 for his tuition during a tour of 40 weeks. The sum he paid was in no sense a premium. It was the ordinary school fee to defray the necessary expenses incurred for the services of experienced professors. All travelling expenses were paid by the management. The teachers included Constance Benson, Paul Burton, who had trained in the Paris Conservatoire and who brought French methods of elocution that Benson especially admired, and Genevieve Ward, the distinguished tragedian, who played guest roles with the company. Their curriculum was common for the time. Benson described it as elocution, dancing, fencing, calisthenics, rehearsal, and general technique. While Nora Nicholson recalled, "We travelled with the company, spent our mornings in class, drama, diction, dancing and fencing, attended rehearsals when needed and walked on at night, usually 7 plays per week." Reflecting Benson's own interests and aptitudes, there was considerable emphasis on physical skills to include a graceful and noble stage bearing. The pupils took part in games of hockey and cricket and other aspects that were an integral and unfairly mocked part of Bensonian life. Nora Nicholson thought, "Our training was first class," and Desmond Chapman Houston that never was time or money better spent, as talent flowered in the happy, congenial, enthusiastic background. It may be noted for clarity that the Benson Company's touring school was distinct from the later Lady Benson School, which began successfully in London in 1919 when Frank and Constance began to part. Never heard of Lady Benson School. Apart from these companies with their own form of training, there were several individual tutors of high reputation who taught pupils privately. Herman Vezin was one of the doyens of the breed, the best-known teacher of acting in England. He was an American-born and educated at the University of Pennsylvania, but had a long, successful acting career in England. By the 1890s, he was in his 60s and devoted himself to teaching in his studio by Waterloo Bridge. He laid stress on the capacity for rapid speech with very clear enunciation. He would make a pupil repeat each letter of the alphabet until I was able to set them all slipping off my tongue or through my teeth with amazing rapidity. He also appreciated the connection between physical training and the voice, making his pupils glean and pitch imaginary sheaves to strengthen the shoulders, extend the lungs, and cultivate rounded gestures. That information about Henry Vezin comes from books by Sir Frank Benson, one called I Want to Go on the Stage, and one called My Memoirs. Sir Frank Benson, who studied with him, admired Vezin as an exceedingly well-read, cultivated man. An encyclopedia of dramatic acting experience, exercise, and training. Certainly, he was the most important single private tutor training actors in the 1890 to 1914 period. The foremost woman teacher of drama was Rosina Philippi, who had trained with Vezin and enjoyed a successful career with Benson and Tree. A wildly energetic, gypsy-like and exciting actress, she was a half-sister of the great Eleonora Duser. Eleonora Duser, of course, was one of the most important actors of the age, and had a huge influence on all kinds of acting teachers and theorists, including people like Stanislavski and Demidov. Admired Duser hugely, and Bernard Shaw, and vast. I don't know this thing about Rosina Philippi being a half sister of Duser. I've only read that here in this book. Fascinating. She taught her groups in rehearsal classes in Chandos Hall, Maiden Lane, and then in King Street, Covent Garden. Miss Philippi's classes were well known in London, and playwrights like Shaw would come to watch their own pieces being rehearsed by her, including at the Academy of Dramatic Art, actually. Most of her teaching was in speech, with emphasis on full vowels and sharp consonants, but she also paid attention to stage movement and dancing. Most importantly, each term was concluded with a public performance at the Court Theatre for parents and friends, and especially in London, managers, who were prospective employers. Sir Lewis Casson and Sir Felix Aylmer, whose speech reflected something of the Vezin and Philippi concern for precise diction, were among Miss Philippi's pupils, and she also taught at the New Academy of Dramatic Art. There we go. In a wider context, she was unwittingly the originator of the modern Old Vic Shakespearean tradition. She preceded Lillian Bayliss in experimenting with bringing Shakespeare to the people after Emma Conn's death in 1912. A third leading private tutor was Walter Lacey. I've never heard of Walter Lacey, don't know anything about him, who had acted with Samuel Phelps. His significance was that Irving sent actors in need of further training to him. Ellen Terry also deferred to him in speech matters, while Violet Vanbrugh was sent to Lacey by Baroness Burden Courts, one of Irving's close friends, to learn the grand manner and the speaking of Shakespearean verse. Okay, Walter Lacey. As well as these freelancers, more formally established colleges in London provided some education for intending actors. The City of London College at Moorgate taught elocution, and Robertson Hare attended Edward Minshall's class there around 1906. Academies, originally or primarily devoted to music, often taught drama and elocution. This training was valuable for singers, especially in opera, but was also useful for non-singing actors. The London Academy of Music was founded in 1861 and taught elocution from the 1860s. A later tutor was Gustave Garcia, who published The Actor's Art in 1882, incorporating his version of François Delsarte's system of teaching forms of gesture and expression to convey emotion. Michael Sanderson picks this up, but I think it was Gustave Garcia's father, maybe it was even Gustave Garcia, who invented the laryngoscope. It was an early attempt at a scientific approach to the training of actors and was embodied in Garcia's teaching at the London Academy from 1882 to 1904. Finally, the Guildhall School of Music was founded in 1880. Reginald Denham, who was there in 1910, recalled that it had splendid courses in voice, speech and gesture, and a list of famous teachers. The Guildhall, there we go. Best known was Kate Rourke, a leading lady with Sir John Hare, who went to teach at the Guildhall on her retirement from the stage in 1907. While Paul Burton, who taught elocution and drama, embodying much of the technique of the Comédie Française. In addition to these chartered academies, there were several private enterprise colleges of varying degrees of stability and repute, usually run by retired actors. Well regarded was Henry Neville's Dramatic Academy, founded in 1884. Neville, with over 25 years stage experience before he began his academy with his brother, was a former actor-manager and playwright, noted as a melodramatic comedy hero. As a member of the Garrick Club, he had a status and accessibility to contacts rare among academy proprietors. Especially well-loved by its pupils was Cairns James Academy in Oxford Street. Cairns James had been a noted comedian with the Gilbert and Sullivan operas at the Savoy, and his partner, Ernest Daubin, had been stage manager at Drury Lane. Leslie Henson recalled the curriculum. Ken James taught elocution and gave expert instruction in scenes from plays. Ernest Daubin taught singing, and fencing lessons were given as part of our regular curriculum. Gerald de Maurier devised and adjudicated improvisation exercises. The school trained Leslie Henson, Robertson Hare, Clements Dane, and Reginald Denham. Its happy and hard-working atmosphere proving successful in nurturing comic talents. I love Sanderson's take on this. He says, "It's remarkable that there were so many valuable opportunities for elocution and drama training even before the founding of RADA and the Central School. In a field that one might expect to have been wide open to all kinds of charlatanism and quackery, there was a good deal of serious work in a quite new area of private education. This may be due to three factors. Firstly, a great many of the new aspirants to the stage came from middle and upper middle class backgrounds with parents well used to evaluating private education, less easily hoodwinked and confident enough to see they were getting value for money. Secondly, the fact that many teachers taught in more than one institution maintained a roughly common standard. For example, Kate Rourke and Rosina Philippi not only taught privately, but at the Guildhall and RADA respectively. Thirdly, many of these teachers had had long and successful careers on the stage before taking up teaching. The ready availability of tutors of good quality, whom the serious aspirant could contact with a little judicious inquiry, helps to counteract the potential growth of a semi-fraudulent sector, which would have brought discredit on the stage. It's remarkable that actors' memoirs which recall these early forms of training depict them with affection and gratitude as valuable places of hard work and enthusiasm." So there we go. That's a little sort of trip, a pretty fantastic trip around actor training before the foundation of the big drama schools. I think, didn't Clive Barker in our last podcast call that a sort of proto-academy or pre-academy? I think something along those lines. So now I'm going to read you an account of somebody going to one of these schools in 1890. So, you know, that's still 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 years before the foundation of the other big academies, or 15 or 16 years. So quite a while before Alda and the Central School get going, a stage-struck actress like Winifred, or wannabe actress like Winifred Dolan, had no opportunity to attend one of those academies. There's a nice account of her sort of realizing she's been acting at school, and there's this account of her asking her parents or seeking her parents' permission to be an actor. So the end of chapter one goes like this. The next day was a Saturday. I was sitting with my mother talking it over when she said, two men asked to be introduced to me. One was the manager at the Grand, and he said his friend was also a manager somewhere. They wished to congratulate me on my daughter's performance. One of them said, I suppose, of course, she will adopt the stage as a profession. But I said, certainly not. And they bowed themselves off. I could see them with their tails between their legs, poor things. A moment's dead silence, and then under my breath I said half to myself, I wish to God I could. To my astonishment, my mother said, do you want to go on the stage? More than anything in the world, I replied. Only, I suppose, as a Catholic. What has that got to do with it? She said. There are lots of Catholics on the stage. Kate and Mary Rourke, for instance. And what about Mrs. Siddons and all the Kembles? But I thought, my dear child, you can serve God and save your soul in any walk of life. Don't be a prig. It all depends on yourself. Quickly, I said, would you let me go? Oh, well, I must talk that over with your father. There's a lot to... I'll go and talk to my father now, I said, and went into the next room where he was smoking and reading the tablet before the fire. Papa, will you allow me to go on the stage? He laid down his paper, took his pipe out of his mouth, and looked at me. I am told you have real talent. You have shown a strong character at school, and we can trust you. So if you want it, the answer is yes. And with that, he put his pipe back in his mouth and resumed his paper. I was astounded. I couldn't take it in. I went back to my mother. He said yes. It was as simple as that. So there's Winifred Dolan, a young lady in Leeds, 22 years old, I think, deciding that she wants to go on the stage. So then the question is, how do you do it? So Winifred Dolan does something interesting. She sits down and writes to Clement Scott, the drama critic of the Daily Telegraph. She writes, I know now that he was the doyen of all the London critics, occupying a position similar to that of the famous Francesique Sacy of Le Figaro in Paris. I can't remember exactly what I wrote, except that greatly daring I asked him to tell me how a provincial girl with no influence who desired to go on the stage should set about it. This is the letter I received by return of post. People quite often put those kinds of things in on Facebook and similar posts, don't they? I'd like to be an actor. How do I do it? Rather moving that that's what Winifred Dolan wrote back in 1890. So anyway, he writes a letter back and he says, so this is from the 22nd of December, or just before Christmas, 22nd of December, 1890, the great drama critic Clement Scott wrote back to young Winifred Dolan, Dear Miss Dolan, I don't mind confessing that your kind letter has interested me very deeply. The proof of it is that I'm sitting down to answer it, overwhelmed as I am with Christmas work and responsibilities. You don't know what the life of a drama critic is like at Christmas time. I must tell you, I receive countless letters of the same pattern. No, not of the same pattern, for they come for the most part from the frivolous, the empty-headed, and the vain. Your letter is that of an earnest, enthusiastic, educated girl. The others mean vanity, whereas you mean work. And then you're a Catholic, and that brings me nearer to you, for there we are brother and sister, or father and child, as you will. There is so much to be said on the subject, so much I would like to say. The path is so dangerous. Do beware of it. The ascent is so steep, and it would break your young, enthusiastic heart. What am I to do? I want to talk to you, but I'm going to the south of France, and shall not be back in England until the end of January, but I still want to help you. Let me see you when it is possible on my return to London, and write me one line before I leave England next Saturday. I will interest Irving and Ellen Terry on your behalf, be sure. Yours sincerely, Clement Scott. must have been a brilliant letter she wrote to him. She says herself, "Imagine receiving a letter like that." Now, please bear in mind that this was still the Victorian era. No girl could go about unchaperoned. How was I to go to London and call upon a man? A friend I had met during my year in society came to my rescue. Mrs. Murray Hickson was a young widow who lived at Esher in Surrey when she was not keeping house for her father, a county court judge, when his official duties brought him to Leeds. Oh, I see, so this is the Leeds connection. She invited me to stay with her and offered to accompany me to the decisive interview. So she goes and has this sort of chat with Clement Scott. And this is what he says. Mr. Scott. So this is the story. He was a perfect dear. He began by repeating much of what he said in his letter and spent half an hour trying to discourage me. The difficulties were enormous, the moral dangers not to be lightly discarded. The profession, a closed corporation. Influence, of paramount importance. Stage life, a gamble. Plenty of room at the top, but between the rungs of the ladder, at best heartbreak, at worst despair. This moral thing is really interesting. You recall that it was one of the things that Fanny Kelly was really angry about when she set up her school, that there was still an assumption that there was some kind of a connection between actresses and prostitution, or that even that sort of implication was so dangerous to actresses that the assumption was there that that was part of the reason why when they became successful they were quite well rewarded. And clearly something similar is lurking around these conversations. Mr. Scott said that people who caught the stage fever were so besotted they would never quit, however unsuccessful. They sank and sank, but hung on grimly even at the cost of semi-starvation and wasted lives. I listened, and when he had finished, I said, "I think I know all that. I've faced it. I only want my chance to make good. If I fail, I will accept the verdict and I shall quit. Please give me my chance." I shall never forget his smile. He had been trying me out. He said briskly, "Very well, now you mean business." All the old stagers learned their jobs in two great stock companies. "Bath and Bristol," I interjected. He laughed appreciatively and went on. "They are gone. There is only one left, at Margate, in Kent. Miss Sarah Thorne takes pupils for a fee. Go to her for 6 months and then come and see me again. Good luck and God bless you." That's nice, clear advice, isn't it? Go to Miss Sarah Thorne in Margate. That's the path. My mother and I later went to fix things up with Miss Thorne, who lived somewhere in West Kensington. She was a dear lady, most respectable. She quite dispelled the qualms of my mother, who I think had begun to have misgivings at the way her duckling was taking to water. The interview was not without its humour. My mother said, "I should never allow my daughter to wear tights." They're from Leeds. That's not a very good Leeds accent. Never mind. But Miss T was equal to the occasion. "My young ladies never wear tights," she said. "I train for the legitimate." Should probably read the footnote on this. So the legitimate theatre, what's that? So there's a nice footnote. "The bestowal of letters patent by Charles II on Thomas Killigrew and William Davenant after Charles's restoration to the throne in 1660 reserved to their theatres in London, Drury Lane and Covent Garden, and others with the royal imprimatur throughout Britain, the monopoly rights to perform the spoken drama in Britain." These were known as the patent theatres and generally designated Theatre Royal. For example, Theatre Royal at Margate, at which Dolan makes her debut. The monopoly rights of the patent theatres to perform the spoken drama were enforced by the Theatres Act of 1737. And were debated in the 1832 House of Commons Select Committee on Dramatic Literature. The rights of the patent houses were not removed until the 1843 Theatres Regulation Act, while censorship of scripts by the Lord Chamberlain's office remained until 1968. The spoken drama, or regular drama, was also known as the legitimate drama, as it represented an amalgam of law and customary practice in the theatre industry. After 1843, the legitimate drama became less a legal term and more indicative of aesthetic valuation of some genres, particularly verse comedy and high comedy. Over illegitimate entertainments such as melodrama, burlesque, pantomime, puppet theatre and musicals, all of which relied on song, dance and spectacle rather than words. Dolan's memoir demonstrates that outdated legal categories of drama still carried social and aesthetic value. That was Andy Morton's footnote there, so thank you to Andy Morton. So Sarah Thorne trains for the legitimate. It was Greek to my mother, but the wise lady had guessed that she had been thinking of burlesque and panto. The fee was £26, and it was agreed I should join the company at Margate on the 1st of May 1891, when her season opened. 2 more months to wait. We went home again for me to take my leave of our friends. They were all thrilled when they heard I was going on the stage and gave me a wonderful send-off. The school and staff presented me with a silver-mounted dressing bag and the committee a cheque for £15. Other presents included a cabin trunk for when you go to America, a travelling flask, opera glasses and a handsome umbrella in memory of Rosabella. It was a part she played when she was at school and finding her way. An old lady whom I dearly loved had left me £100 when she died, so on the 30th of April, 1891, with this capital, all my belongings and high hopes, my father put me on the train at Leeds. I was launched into the world to sink or swim. Well, what fun. All right. So what happens to Winifred Dolan? So, she arrives in Margate. The old Theatre Royal at Margate had one of the richest histories of any theatre in the country. It was the last of the old patent theatres. We just heard what patent theatre means. So those, you recall, were theatres that could perform legitimate drama outside of the two London theatres. Ranking, in that respect, with the Theatres Royal of Bath, Bristol and York. In its time, it had seen the triumphs of such famous players as Edmund Kean, Mrs. Siddons and Charles Matthews. It was the last real stock theatre in the country, and Miss Thorne was a member of a well-known theatrical family. Upon my arrival, I drove in a cab to her house and asked if I might leave my trunk there while I went to look for lodgings. "My dear child," she cried, "do you mean to say you have come alone? I will give you an address. Go and see Mrs. Blair. She lives just opposite the stage door. If she can take you in, she will look after you very well." I went, and she did. I wonder if they still have theatrical digs. I remember when I was touring years ago in the 90s, every theatre would have a list of sort of people locally who you could stay with, and it was quite a mix. It was quite an interesting sort of experience travelling around and staying with a different person every week. They varied hugely in disposition and inclination, hugely. Is that still a thing, theatrical digs? Don't know. Guess it probably is. So she's going to see Mrs. Blair. She was a plump, motherly lady with a pretty daughter. I had a small bedroom and a tiny sitting room about 10 feet square, and she fed me like a turkey cock, all for £2 a week. I'm not sure what that means. Probably well, I would imagine. Probably turkeys are big birds, aren't they? So she got wonderful food for £2 a week. It was my first experience of theatrical landladies who are a race apart. They will nurse you when you are ill, darn your socks if you're a man, and keep you in order if you're inclined to be flighty. Gentlemen are not to be invited home to supper. God bless those landladies. The touring actors and actresses are ever ready to acknowledge the debt they owe them. Next day, there was a rehearsal call for 10 a.m., and Miss Thorne introduced all the newcomers to each other and to a few old-timers from last year's season. There were about 20 of us. Then, parts were handed out to some of us, and I was one of the lucky ones. The script consisted merely of cues and lines. So they still use cue scripts. But I could see it was an ingenue role with plenty of comedy in it. I had to pick up the play as we went along. The bill posters, already up, announced the play as The World Against Her. It was in 5 acts, and I forget how many scenes. Obviously, a melodrama. We started rehearsals at once. The leading lady, on the strength of being last season's pupil, gave herself tremendous airs. It was she who had the world against her, was kidnapped and imprisoned until rescued by the leading man. The villain was played by Lyle Sweet, and he really bore the play on his shoulders. Then there was Bea Berkley, a tall girl with a face rather like a handsome horse. She was as good as gold in this one, but really her line was wicked women. Now, in 1891, no lady ever crossed her legs. She crossed her ankles instead. So if you crossed your legs and showed 5 inches of shin, especially if, in so doing, you revealed a seductive rose-pink frilly petticoat, the audience knew at once what to expect. But if you added a cigarette, you were beyond the pale, past redemption, a villainess in excelsis. B was all that. Heroines, on the other hand, were expected to be virtuous to the point of inanity, while the most popular stock hero was the gentleman roué, who always made good in the final act. To this day, I remember with glee, in some melodrama or other, the audible shudder that ran through the pit when the hero of this type came into the public house and lit his cigar with a £5 note. Yes, audiences were very unsophisticated in those days. They would weep and laugh and hiss the villain and thoroughly enjoy themselves. To return to my debut at the Theatre Royal. There was an extraordinarily large man in the company who supplied the low comedy, while my lover and I were responsible for the light comedy. My lover, he who shall be nameless, was a man of about 40 with brown hair, but prematurely bald and much shorter than myself. It seemed he wanted to be a playwright and had come to learn something of stage technique. He had never acted in his life. After we were pat with our words, nice expression, we had a band rehearsal for music cues. The orchestra was a family affair. Their name was Gates. Mrs. Gates played the piano or harmonium in church scenes, Percy the violin, Alf the cornet, while Harold, in knickerbockers, worked the side drum. Pa Gates sat with a double bass between his knees and drew the bow across to emit a deep plom-plom in tense moments, which happily were rare, also underscoring. That's funny, isn't it? I was reading a review recently about somebody a couple of years ago complaining about all the underscoring in the National. But there you go, a deep plom-plom in tense scene. Nothing changes. He did not add much to the ensemble, but it looked well. The conductor was a Miss Ballard. At last, the sun rose on the 17th of May, 1891. So she's been there for 17 days. It was Whit Monday, and we were told to expect a bumper house for the bank holiday. As we sat making up in the dressing room that night, we could hear through the thin walls the audience assembling. I love that bit. Do you love that bit? I love that bit when the audience is coming in. We were on the same story as the gallery, and to judge by the nut-cracking, whistling and amiable back-chat, we were in for a lively time. And so it proved. Mr. Wade, one of the old-timers, was my father, and we made our first entrance together. I was never so nervous in my life. Just a cloth behind me, and not so much as a chair to keep me company. Mr. Wade whispered, "Give it to 'em hot. There's our cue. Come on." And then we were on, and the ice was broken. Next came a scene with my lover. It didn't go too badly, but he mumbled with fright, and as he'd covered his bald pate with a reddish wig, they kept shouting, "Speak up, Ginger!" And when we came to the "Speak up, Ginger," brilliant. And when we came to the love scene in which he proposes and I accept him, the poor man went to pieces altogether. I could see exactly what had happened. He had, as we say, stepped out of his part and found himself, to his embarrassment, making love to Miss Dolan in front of all these people. He forgot I was whatever my name was in the play. Of course, he tried hopelessly. Now, the audience that night... Speak up, Ginger. Now, the audience that night consisted of townsfolk, with fisher lads in the gallery. They knew the play by heart, and actually started prompting him, making matters worse. The last line I'd spoken before the hiatus was, "Kiss me, Herbert." It was that which had so upset him, because we leave out kisses at rehearsal. Ah, there you go. Interesting. So intimacy protocol. No kisses in rehearsals. So I hurled myself into the breach and clasped him in my arms, repeating, "Kiss me again, Herbert. Kiss me again, ad nauseam," until the house was convulsed and thundered its applause. We actually got a special call in front of the curtain when it was all over. Another night, when we were playing this piece, there was a second contretemps. I had a little scene on the stage by myself this time, and my last line should have brought on another character in the cast, but the girl was missing, and there was a stage wait. I improvised for about 3 minutes. Well done, Winifred. That's a long old time to improvise. An agonising long time in a play. The next entrance, after the missing girls, was the leading ladies, and she wouldn't come on for fear the audience would think she was to blame for the wait. Dear Miss Thorne came to the rescue, literally shoving her out onto the stage. I'm ashamed to confess that I was rather disgusted at being cast in such stuff as this full-blooded melodrama, but it taught me a lesson. I realised after that first night the value of broad effects, so essential when playing in large theatres, especially in the provinces. Also, nowadays, the ham actor is taboo. But this is written in the 40s, I think. Interesting. But I've often thought how useful such training is and would be to the modern naturalistic actor when he had to tackle Lear or Mark Antony's speech in Julius Caesar, for instance. Miss Thorne knew her job. So Winifred Dolan is saying that acting in the 1940s was naturalistic. The bill changed twice a week, and we were rehearsed in the classics, farce, domestic drama and drawing room comedy. Shakespeare and Sheridan were not attempted until circumstances permitted. That is to say, when some former pupil who had made good in a small way in London came down for a week or two for further practice, when they would be given star billing. We were expected to attend all rehearsals. So this is the training itself. Sitting in front of, if not personally engaged in the piece being rehearsed. We might be required to walk on, in crowds, or as guests. One learned valuable experience in dressing the stage, by play, and so forth. By play is this sort of idea that's out of fashion of sort of doing physical things that indicate something psychological about the character. It was much a much sort of loved and talked about technique of Victorian actors, by play. Really interesting. There was also a fencing class which I attended. We were kept pretty busy, and I was perfectly happy. We had our little sensations too. One recruit was a Bensonian who always wore +4s. He soon got engaged to Miss Blakiston, an idyll which was no sooner on than off. Then there were two flashy girls who called themselves Montmorency. One was a brunette, the other blonde. One day, Mr. Wade and the blonde went to London and returned in time for the evening show. Married. Good heavens. Unfortunately, the girl turned out to be a ward in Chancery and there were legal proceedings. Miss Thorne was furious. Bet she was. Another day, the ladies in the company were all agog because a new man was coming who had been an attaché somewhere. He turned out to be a very handsome and aristocratic, but he didn't stay long. It's like a sort of Terence Rattigan play, isn't it? No coward. He was no more promising as an actor than he had apparently been as a diplomat. But at last, a greater sensation caused a real flutter in the Dovecot. Ellen Terry's son, Gordon Craig, known as Teddy, who was playing small parts at the Lyceum, came to join us for a short time. Miss Thorne was going to put on Sheridan Knowles' blank verse drama, The Hunchback, for him, and she cast me to play opposite him. Teddy acting Modus, and I Helen, one of his mother's parts, long before she met Irving. Isn't that amazing? So there, young Winifred Dolan, having her adventure at Margate, is about to act with Gordon Craig, who's, of course, one of the sort of major figures of 20th century theatre, certainly as a sort of a theorist and thinker, and of course famously designed and directed Stanislavski's production of Hamlet in the Moscow Arts Theatre. Amazing. This was my very first costume, or period play, and I had to study manner. I was, of course, elated, but very, very nervous, for here my past experience as an amateur stood me in no stead at all. Teddy Craig was delightful to act with. But Miss Thorne gave me no help whatever. She left me to see what I could make of it. There's an interview with Sarah Thorne that that I might read another time, and in there she says you can't teach people to act. So she's not sort of a brilliant acting teacher, apparently not one at all. After we played The Hunchback some half a dozen times, she was on the stage one day at rehearsal and, coming behind me, put her fingers under my elbows and lifted my arms. "Never make a gesture with a bent arm, dear. Always from the shoulder," she said. It was the first criticism she had yet passed on me. "Oh, Miss Thorne," I said, "do tell me, am I any good?" "My dear," she replied, "I can teach you nothing. It's all there. What you want is practice. Try to play as many parts as you can possibly get hold of. You are the legitimate successor of Maud Millett." I think we need this note. Maud Millett, much photographed English actress, particularly successful in ingenue and light comedy roles. Anyway, Winifred's delighted. She says, "I could have kissed her." Another recruit joined us at about this time, a very charming boy whose name was Granville Barker. So Granville Barker and Gordon Craig are in Margate at the same time. Destined to become a household name as a producer, well, and writer, and again, sort of theorist, really. Miss Thorne put up Hamlet for Teddy Craig, and he gave a very scholarly performance in the title part, though immature, of course. He was to make his name not as an actor, but as a stage designer on revolutionary lines. He was never a prophet in his own country, but Russia, Germany, and Italy welcomed him with open arms. Gordon Craig, of course, had a sort of a theatre school, and I may do an episode about that later. Next, Miss Evelyn Millard joined us for a time and became our leading lady. She played Juliet in Romeo and Juliet very, very charmingly. She was sweetly pretty, and her diction was perfect. Her father was a well-known teacher of elocution in London. She was to make her name one day as Flavia in The Prisoner of Zenda at the St. James's Theatre. In mid-season, Miss Thorne took her annual benefit, an old custom now obsolete. It was a great occasion. Actors and actresses who had graduated under her guidance and were now veterans on the London stage came to support her, each contributing something to the programme. Among them was Charles Rock, and I was chosen to play the title role with him in The Pretty Horsebreaker, a lovely comedy part. In front of the curtain during one of the intervals, Granville Barker's mother gave a wonderful exhibition of bird calls. And to crown the evening, dear old Miss Thorne herself gave a short scene from Much Ado as Beatrice. It was rather painful, but very touching. That must have been an amazing night. Granville Barker's mum is doing bird calls and sort of aged Miss Thorne does Beatrice from Much Ado. Soon after that, we were told we were going on tour. I wish that would have been a nice night to be at the theatre. Where, we asked, and were told, on the Kentish circuit. It sounded portentous, but entre nous, it was really what was called a fit-up tour, i.e. playing the public halls and corn exchanges in places that had no local theatre. Sometimes we played a week, but more often three-night stands. The Kent circuit also included places in Surrey, such as Leatherhead, Dorking, Guildford and Kingston. I shared digs with B. Berkeley, and of course, Teddy Craig came on tour with us. It was a most amusing experience, and we had such fine weather that summer of 1891. At Leatherhead, Miss Thorne gave the company a treat, a day's picnic to Box Hill in wagonettes. But it's Canterbury that's written on my heart, for it was there that Irving and Ellen Terry came down to see Teddy and me. Another ordeal to go through. We played the Maudus and Helen scenes, and then I was out of the bill again until I played in The World Against Her. Thus, I had a day and a night free, so Uncle Alfred invited me to spend it at Swinford, as Irving and Ellen Terry were coming to luncheon again. Off I went, careful to take my precious photographs with me, lest they should be stolen from my lodgings while I was away. It was lucky indeed I did. When Irving and Ellen Terry drove up to the door where we were gathered to greet them, Ellen cried out, "Why, there she is! My dear child, Henry and I drove up to your lodgings to pick you up, and they said you were out." To this day, it's a source of bitter regret that I did not have that drive. This time, it was like a family party, even Irving unbent. After luncheon, Ellen Terry began signing photographs. "Your affectionate friend, Ellen Terry." Among them was also one of Irving in private life, and another of the two of them as Dr. Primrose and Olivia in The Vicar of Wakefield. She forged Irving's signature, very cleverly too, on the first, and then handed the other over to him, saying, "Now, Henry, you sign this one," which he did, and then she added her own signature to his. Wasn't I proud? Then Irving took both my hands, drew me towards him, and speaking very gravely said, "So, you are one of us now." "Yes, sir. Remember always to uphold the honour of the profession." "Indeed. Yes, sir." We're about to get some acting advice from Henry Irving, by the way. So try this. "And in acting, remember that thought precedes speech. For instance, do not say look and then point, but point first and then say look. Every sentence expresses a new thought. You must pass the words through your mind before you utter them. It's a question of quick thinking." "Thank you, sir," I replied. "God bless you, my dear," he said. It was a wonderful moment, this great actor's lesson to a tyro. I never forgot it. I went back with them, in the train this time, as Irving was changing at Ashford Junction to return to London. As he got out, I heard him say to Ellen Terry, "Don't let that child pay her fare," for I had been bundled in with them, ticketless, by an excited stationmaster. That touch was typical of Irving, and the reason we all loved him in the profession. From that day on, I was admitted into Ellen Terry's family circle. Gone was the callow adoration of the past, and in its place, a close and dear friendship. So, that's the end of the little adventure with Henry Irving and Ellen Terry, and then shortly afterwards, Winifred Dolan receives a truly wonderful surprise. She gets a letter from her uncle Alfred, enclosing one from George Alexander, the actor manager at the St James's Theatre in London, who offers to take her on as staff as an understudy at a guinea a week, so she might get an idea of London theatre. If I find her intelligent, I would try to give her a small part later on. Back to the end of the chapter. "Now my 6 months at Margate were not up until 1st of November, would Miss Thorne let me go? What a greenhorn I was. I did not realise this was a feather in her cap as well as in mine. Of course, she was delighted, elated. I was to go at once. So I telegraphed yes to my uncle and to Mr. Alexander that I was on my way, wrote the news to my mother, packed my cabin trunk, and was in London early next morning, presenting myself at the stage door of the St. James's Theatre about midday. My foot was on the first rung of Mr. Clement Scott's ladder." So there you go. There we spent a bit of time with Winifred Dolan at Sarah Thorne's. I'm not sure. I think we thought it was rather a lovely account. Really enjoyed reading it, actually. But I'm not sure that we learnt much about actor training in the late 19th century, apart from always gesture with a full arm and point before you speak. Well, maybe those are useful thoughts. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed that. Next week, I'm going to interview somebody. Take care. It's a beautiful day today. So I hope you're enjoying that. And thank you for listening, as always. Thanks. Bye.